It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the scratchy popping sound of a vinyl record was once buried in the past, but only briefly. We talk with an audio expert about why that iconic sound is still drawing in listeners.
Now, officials with the state are asking residents to burn or bag Christmas wreaths and other live evergreen plants to prevent the spread of invasive elongate hemlock scale.
The invasive species was found in Wisconsin for the first time in large numbers this holiday season, and our next guest is with us to talk about how this insect should be handled and the impact it could have in the state if it gains a foothold.
Donna Gilson is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Donna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So let's start with what elongate hemlock scale is exactly.
This is an insect that came to the United States from Asia a number of years ago and has become pretty firmly established in the eastern United States, more along the seaboard and up into Maine. It attacks up to 40 different types of conifers, evergreen trees, including hemlock, spruce, and fir, which are some of their favorites. And it makes a little shell on the underside of the needles on these trees and starts feeding and weakens the tree so that it's susceptible to other pests and diseases.
And is this the first time that we've seen this insect here in Wisconsin?
We've been on the lookout for it for about 5 years. We always do inspections of Christmas tree lots and other places that sell cut boughs and cut trees between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And in the past few years, we found, here and there, a couple of trees, a couple of wreaths, and just been able to dispose of them properly and taking care of the problem. But this year, we found it at a number of chains in Wisconsin, national chains, and at multiple outlets of those chains. So it was pretty well scattered all over the state, and that raised some concerns in us that it could escape into the environment and get established here.
So were those found in kind of regular business of DATCAP going out and inspecting things? How often are inspectors out looking for potential problems?
Every Christmas season, we do send our inspectors out to check out Christmas tree lots and the places where they're selling cut trees and cut boughs, just to see if there are any pests there, make sure that they came into the state legally with the proper plant health papers. So, yes, it was found in the routine course of our work.
I'm guessing that you also do similar inspections with, say, bedding plants that come in during the summer.
We have a regular nursery inspection program, and when annual bedding plants, they do have to come into the state with, again, plant health papers, but we focus our attention a little more in nursery stock on perennials rather than annuals, just because of the nature of them, that they're perennial. But we do, if we find any diseases of concern or insects on annuals, we will, if it's something we have the authority to take regulatory action, we will. But we have a core of nursery inspectors who are busy pretty well year-round.
And do we know where these particular infested evergreens came from?
Yes, there were four suppliers in the state of North Carolina that supplied all of these stores. And there was one case up in northern Wisconsin where we also found a company that had brought in just the boughs. They were not prepared wreaths and decorations. They were just the boughs. They were going to make their own wreaths, and they actually had their source was in Virginia, and we also found elongate hemlock scale there, but were able to intercept it before it got out into the marketplace at all. In the case of these chain stores, we were finding it was wreaths and swags, the tabletop arrangements of evergreen boughs and cute little flays and things, that sort of decorations, not trees. We were not talking about trees here at all. So they came into the state already put together and were being sold already assembled.
Donna Gilson is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We're talking about elongate hemlock scale, an invasive species that has been found on some evergreen products in Wisconsin. And Donnie, you said these were found in big box stores. Are there any areas of the state where you found particular clusters of these materials?
No, it was pretty well scattered throughout the state. And I can tell you the names of the stores where we found them, but I don't want people to get a false impression or a false sense of security, because we certainly did not get to every single chain in Wisconsin. So it's conceivable that you could have bought it somewhere else and still had a problem. The only way to be assured that you didn't have it probably was if you know that the wreath or the swags, the boughs, whatever you bought, came from Wisconsin Christmas tree farms.
And speaking of those Wisconsin Christmas tree farms, it is a big economic part of our economy here. And what would happen if this elongate hemlock scale were to spread in the state?
It could be pretty devastating to Christmas tree growers because of the nature of this pest. It has a really complex life cycle. It produces multiple generations in a year. It's got several stages of its life cycle when it feeds, unlike many insects. And the real kicker is that as it's feeding, it forms a shell around itself, a scale, which is where it gets its name. And that it's protective. It protects it from predators, but it also protects it from any kind of insecticide. So growers couldn't just spray to get rid of it. They probably would need to use something, a systemic insecticide that needs to be applied as a soil drench or injected, which is probably prohibitively expensive and labor intensive if you have acres and acres of trees. Fir and spruce species are among the species that are most susceptible to this pest. So those, of course, are some of the species that really are the lifeblood of our Christmas tree farms, too.
And so, Donna, if someone listening has purchased a wreath or, like you said, arrangements that include evergreen boughs, and they're not sure where it came from, what's the best and safest way to dispose of that?
Yeah, if you're uncertain, just go ahead and bag it or burn it. Some people like to put them out on the compost pile, or they'll put them out for the city to collect if they have that service in your community. But the best thing is, if you have a fireplace in your home, go ahead and burn them in the fireplace. Or if you have a fire pit in your yard and, of course, meeting all local ordinances, burn them in your fire pit. If you don't have access to those things, just put them in a garbage bag and tie it up or put a twisty tie on it some way, and go ahead and put it in your trash can, and then your trash collection service will pick it up and it will go to the landfill where it's not going to cause any harm.
Well, Donna, thanks so much for joining us and sharing the information.
Well, thank you for helping us spread the word.
Donna Gilson is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. She joined us today to talk about a new invasive insect that's made its way into the state through wreaths and other live evergreen plants. DATCAP recommends burning these in order to help stop the spread of elongate hemlock scale. Despite the fact that it's more convenient to play a song on Spotify or Pandora than to dig through your records to find the one song you're looking for, and lugging around your prized record collection to a friend's house is much more work than bringing your music along on your cell phone, many people, young and old, still favor vinyl.
Maybe you're kicking yourself for getting rid of your record collection and donating it to the local thrift store years ago. Maybe you're a young listener discovering records for the first time. Whatever the case, it seems clear that vinyl's powerful comeback is here to stay.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a record collection? What is it about vinyl that you love? Why do you choose to listen to LPs instead of maybe just streaming your music online? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Steve Guttenberg has worked as a high-end audio salesman and as a record producer. He currently writes the Audiophiliac blog for CNET.com and hosts the Audiophiliac Daily Show on YouTube, where he reviews equipment, music, and answers all sorts of audio-related questions. He wrote the piece, "Why Do LPs Sound So Good for CNET?" Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Steve, we began seeing a a brand new revival of interest in LP several years ago, and here we are today. Most music and electronic stores are also selling records again, and there are some shops around the country exclusively selling records. Does this surprise you?
No, not at all. Not at all. It surprised me mostly that it goes the other way, that people are, you know, especially if you grew up with vinyl, which would make you an older person, I admit, that people were so eager to get rid of it. But, you know, I think having a physical connection to music is incredibly meaningful. That is, holding a record or even a CD in your hand, but having a physical copy of that music means something. And you know, I want to just put it this way. You know, I have records I bought as a teenager, and I always took good care of my records. So I still have those records, not as keepsakes. I still listen to them. And it brings back memories of, you know, I was with my girlfriend when I got this record, or I bought this one when I was in California. And that kind of connection that goes on for decades and decades and decades. I worry about people who only listen to streaming music or downloaded music, whereas they, you know, grow older, if they never had a physical connection to a specific song or album, how will they relate to that music? You know, will it be as meaningful to them as it is to me? I mean, there's no way to know the answer to that question, but I don't know. It's something I think about.
For me, Steve, being 50 years old, I have a connection to vinyl records and 45s myself, but for our younger listeners who might be unfamiliar with the sound of records, how do you best describe the sound of vinyl?
Well, I think it's a tough question to answer in a quick, short way, because the cliche is it sounds more, in quotes, musical. It sounds more like real music, although it tends to mean that it's more about acoustic, you know, non-amplified, not electronic music, but it can sound more like music. But more than the sound of it, I think one of the biggest, let's say, dividing lines between listening to a vinyl, you know, record versus listening to it streamed or even a CD is the way it engages the listener. I did a story years ago where I interviewed seven people who were under 40 years old who just got their first turntable. And what they all told me is that they noticed when they played records, they didn't multitask. They put the record on the platter, they put the stylus in the groove, and they started listening to music, and they listened to it. When they streamed, they had music on, and they did other things. And the fact that every single person, the youngest was 14 years old, so it wasn't a nostalgia trip for him. And yet he noticed that he didn't multitask when he listened to vinyl.
Steve Guttenberg joins us. He currently writes the Audiophiliac blog for CNET.com. He also hosts the Audiophiliac Daily Show on YouTube, where he reviews equipment, music, and answers all sorts of audio-related questions. We are talking about his piece in CNET called Why Do LPs Sound So Good? And we're talking about the comeback of vinyl right here on Central Time. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Crash in Milwaukee. Good afternoon, Crash. Welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I haven't read the article in CNET yet, but I want to check it out.
You have a question for Steve?
Well, I just want to make a comment, and I'd love to hear Steve's take on it. I'm an audio engineer, and I often talk about why I listen to vinyl, and there's so much to be said for the psychoacoustics of analog sound versus digital sound and the way it affects your nervous system. Like, they're getting better and better at, like, packing the bits full of the sounds that we hear. But there's a lot of things about vinyl that you don't actually hear, but it affects your nervous system differently than what you're I'm talking about stuff above the range of human hearing, but they have problems with digital recordings and those artifacts actually causing you to have what's called listener fatigue sooner. And that's why I listen to vinyl. And I know the equipment can be cost prohibitive, but if you get good equipment, the stuff that can really bring vinyl to life, that stuff's built to last 20, 30, even 50 years.
That's true. Long lifetime, useful service life for a turntable. I have friends. I have a very close friend. I was with him when he bought his turntable in 1972. He still plays it, and I mean plays it every day. He's a musician. He's home during the day. He listens to vinyl every day on this turntable he bought in 1972.
Steve, you know, Crash talked about the sound waves. I know you talked about part of the appeal might be the physicality of it, you know, holding a record, putting the record on the turntable and putting the needle down on it. Is there such thing as the sound waves maybe being at least unknowingly to a listener a lot better than maybe a sound like digital?
Well, yeah, I think that's where that engagement part comes from, right? That people who listen to vinyl are more likely to actually listen to it as opposed to have it on as background sound. And that says a lot, because people nowadays are sort of, let's say, programmed not to listen. They have music on all the time. They just can't focus entirely on music. They have to do something else while they listen to music. Well, people who listen to vinyl are more likely to actually just sit and listen to it.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Deborah in Milwaukee. Good afternoon, Deborah. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I just tuned in, so I'm a little off the conversation about specifically vinyl, but I'm looking at a little, it's got a Knight, it's K-N-I-G-H-T, Allied Radio Corporation, Chicago, and a little 45 RPM record player that came with the house, and which was built in 1950, and about 1045 RPMs. And we've listened to them a couple times, but I'm 61. I grew up listening to Barbara Streisand. My mom played records constantly. And I literally think that's the foundation of my appreciation for music, which hopefully I think is the universal language that will save the world someday. But I think whatever form I listen to music in is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Thank you for the call, Deborah. What did you think of Deborah's comments about just the format of music that she listens to?
To 45s it was?
Yeah.
Sure. It's all vinyl. It's all analog to me. So, yeah, it reaches people in a different way.
Steve, what do you see as potential drawbacks to this format? And what I mean by that is, one of the things that I think both I and many people have noticed is if you try to buy a quality turntable nowadays, it's very expensive. Whereas, you know, maybe 10-15 years ago, where when it wasn't kind of the in thing anymore, you could find it in any garage sale or at a thrift shop. Are there other drawbacks to the format other than that?
No. And by the way, I mean, in preparation for our talk, I did put together a list of turntables that I recommend, and they start at $100.
Okay.
So I don't think that price should be an impediment to someone getting into vinyl for the first time, or someone who's already had it in their youth and are coming back to it now. For $100, you can get a very nice turntable. And of course, you can spend more money and buy a nicer turntable, but starting at $100, on Amazon or wherever, it shouldn't be a problem. I think the thing is the, in quotes, work of playing records. I think you have to pick the record you're going to play,
right,
take it out of the rack, walk over to the turntable, take it out of the sleeve, put it on the... It's way more work than playing, you know, streaming Spotify, right? So, but that's part of the thing that makes it good, is that you're more involved. You've made a conscious decision to play this album as opposed to just streaming whatever. You know, the engagement is key.
Steve, as far as repair and maintenance goes, you know, back in the days when you used to have to replace the needle because the needle wore out, I mean, how easy is it to find parts for these?
Well, you know, thanks to the internet, that's one thing, is it's easy to find stuff on the internet that would be hard to find in a local store. So finding a replacement stylus for your cartridge, assuming it's not, you know, 50 years old, isn't terribly difficult. That's the only thing that really, you know, wears out on a turntable is a stylus. You know, from every few years, if you have a record collection that's important to you and you do play lots of records, you should replace the stylus every 2 or 3 years.
Where do you see the future going for LPs?
I think it's just going to continue to grow for a number of reasons beyond the ones we've just discussed. I think also because artists, remember them?
Yes.
They actually make money when you buy a record. It's kind of crazy that way, right? They actually make money. And I was once at some sort of technical convention. It was somebody who owned a record company, and he said something like, it took 17,000 streams for him to make as much money as he did from the sale of one LP.
Wow.
So quite a ratio. So the fact that artists are making records because some of their fans at least want them, and not just want them, but treasure them for some of the reasons I discussed before, that's a physical artifact of their music that they will have, hopefully, for a long time, if that music, you know, still is important to them as the decades roll by.
And finally, with about a minute left, Steve, do you think we're just going to see more technology and more records hit the market?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just want to name that $100 turntable.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's called, the company name is Audio Technica, and the model is ATLP60.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Totally my pleasure. Thank you.
Steve Guttenberg writes the Audiophiliac blog for CNET.com and hosts the Audiophiliac Daily Show on YouTube. He joined us to talk about why vinyl records continue to be a format of choice for many music listeners. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the academic world is often seen as isolated and elitist. We'll talk about why its relationship with the public is important and how to improve it.
First, comics have been a big part of popular culture for many years, and the comics world still has a lot more to offer, from the dozens of superhero films that hit the cinema year after year to the critically acclaimed musical Fun Home, based on Alison Bechdel's groundbreaking comic.
Comics don't need to be about superheroes, though, nor do comics actually have to be funny. The format of comics, combining images with words, is uniquely suited to handle all sorts of complex topics, from disasters and wars to illness and disability.
Hilary Chute is an expert on comics and graphic narratives and a distinguished professor of English and art and design at Northeastern University. She is the author of several books about comics and cartoonists, including her latest called Why Comics? From Underground to Everywhere. Hilary, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. And Hilary, I want to start with you. Did you grow up reading comics? And do you remember some of the first ones you read?
Thanks for that question. So I grew up, I think, like a lot of kids in my generation, loving Garfield, which is one of the most successful comic strips of all time and is syndicated even in Russia. I also loved Tintin and Asterix, but I wasn't a huge fan of comics. It wasn't really until I got to graduate school studying for my PhD that I got really involved in being a fan of comics.
Is there a difference between, like, reading a Garfield comic or Peanuts as opposed to, you know, picking up a comic book and reading about the Fantastic Four or X-Men?
Well, I think that format, it is really something that makes a big difference to comics reading. I mean, Art Spiegelman, the cartoonist behind the graphic memoir Mouse, has this great line. He says it takes more time not to read Ernie Bushmiller's strip Nancy than it does to read it. So there's something about the four-panel strip that you see in the paper that's a sort of instant consumption, whereas you need to really make a choice to go out and buy a comic book, a Marvel comic book, for example. So there's something that's a little bit more dedicated about being a comic book reader.
Speaking of the four-panel strip, that was first invented in the 1890s, which looks quite different than the comics world of today. Can you talk a little bit about the early days of comics and who was reading them and who was writing them?
Sure. It's such an interesting time. So in the 1890s, we get the first comic strip where there are sequential panels. So there had previously been, you know, cartoons that were published, and cartoons are single panel images. And the term comics implies sequence. So the very first official comic strip was a comic strip that was technically called Hogan's Alley, but was nicknamed the Yellow Kid. And that first appeared in 1895, and it starred a child who lived on the Lower East Side in New York City, and he wore a yellow nightshirt. And when this strip first started out, the words would be printed on his nightshirt. And then eventually they came to be emitted from his mouth in what are called speech balloons. So the readership for this comic strip was pretty interesting. So this was the era of the sensational press, you know, figures like Hearst and Pulitzer trying to increase the readerships of, you know, papers like the New York World. And comic strips were thought to appeal to children, for one, but also to populations who didn't have full literacy. So they were meant to appeal to immigrants. And a lot of the community depicted in a strip like The Yellow Kid, they were immigrant communities. So it was a drive to increase circulation specifically aimed at immigrants, which is pretty interesting.
We are talking about the evolution of comics and graphic novels with Hillary Chute. She is an expert on comics and graphic narratives. She is a distinguished professor of English and art and design at Northeastern University. She has a latest book. It's out called Why Comics From Underground to Everywhere. And you were talking about the comic strip. And now we go into the 1930s. We go from having just a comic strip to now a comic book. So from that period, what did the world of comics look like?
So the thing that happened in the 1930s that just blew this whole field open is that superheroes were invented. So superheroes are really an American invention. The format of the comic book, so the floppy pamphlet-sized thing that we associate with comic book, really took off with the first superhero, who is Superman, who was invented by two teenagers living in Cleveland, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And I find this so moving. Siegel and Shuster first came up with the character Superman in high school, and they first created an iteration of him in a science fiction fanzine that they self-published. And of course, Superman went on to change the whole genre, and he was so popular that other superheroes started entering the scene. So it was really this one figure, Superman, that created this whole movement of other superheroes like Batman and Wonder Woman. And, you know, the golden age of superheroes really began in the late 30s and went up through the 1950s.
Now, the graphic novel has formally come about probably in the early to mid 1970s, but it seems not all comic artists are happy with that term. Can you talk a little bit about what graphic novel describes and how the comics community views it?
Sure. So I feel like all forms that are relatively new, and I would say at least in an American context, you know, comics is less than 120 years old or so. I think they deal with these awkward issues around nomenclature. So comics is a medium. I know that sounds really awkward. A lot of my editors always want to get me to revise that. But I say that comics is a medium, like film is a medium, and they're all of these different formats. Now, in the 1980s, the so-called graphic novel picked up steam as a term within publishing. And it was a very helpful moment because works like Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which came out in two volumes, the first in 1986 and the second in 1991, were breaking into a literary sphere. So Mouse, for example, the Mouse series, won a special Pulitzer Prize in 1992. But people didn't really know how to talk about this work. So graphic novel became a term that connoted a certain kind of prestige. It connoted something book length. But a lot of cartoonists don't like graphic novel, in part because it's really a term coming from publishing and advertising, and also because some cartoonists find it in its sort of bid for prestige to be a term that covers over the mass medium roots of comics, which is something that a lot of cartoonists feel close to, that kind of accessibility, that kind of democracy of forms that comics has represented in the United States. For example, when I was, you know, talking about comic strips being marketed in the 1890s to immigrants. So a lot of cartoonists don't want to lose that so-called disreputable history, but they want to own it. And for them, it's part of the power of this form as a democratic art form.
Hillary, you were talking about comics and then the evolution, the graphic novels, and of course there's still comics today, but is, using an example, there's a difference between the old Batman comics and the regular Batman comics and then the Dark Knight series. Is that an example of moving into more of the graphic novel as opposed to just a simple comic? And I'm talking about specifically the Dark Knight series.
Yes. So one of the things that started happening in the 80s, along with work like Art Spiegelman's Mouse, is that a lot of these comic storylines, for example, Batman, which you mentioned, were being written by serious writers who added a lot of dark content to those stories. So one of the amazing things about superheroes from a literary perspective is that their stories can be written and rewritten constantly, yeah. Right? There's a sort of template and there's a sort of like endless supply of different angles on a story. And so The Dark Knight came out of that moment in the 80s and was extremely powerful, had a really big impact with readers. And then, of course, we know that there were the Dark Knight movies that captured a lot of that darkness that felt very adult, that felt like it was marking a difference from comics for kids and comics that had content that was about trauma, content that was about pain, content that, an intellectual adult person would want to read about.
We're talking with Hillary Chute, a comic scholar and author of many books about comics, including her latest called Why Comics: From Underground to Everywhere. She is walking us through the history of comics and just how diverse the genre is today.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your experience with comics? Did you grow up always waiting for the Sunday Funnies page? Have you read some adult comics or graphic novels? Let us know how comics have affected you and why you enjoy reading them. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. We're talking with Hillary Chute. She is an expert on comics and a distinguished professor of English and Art and Design at Northeastern University. She's talking with us about her latest book called Why Comics: From Underground to Everywhere.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you read some graphic novels or comics that you loved? Let us know what they were. Do you have fond memories of reading the comics in the newspaper? Why did you like them so much? Do you need a comics recommendation? Hillary can help. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's go to the phones. Let's go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Good afternoon, Charlie. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I must tell your guests that I truly love comics, and I've been in love with comics and newspaper reading since I was very young. And more than anything, it was the Amazing Spider-Man or Little Orphan Annie, or even just glancing at a family circle that drew my attention. But I did, while growing up, and something that really spurred my interest in reading and wanting to read more was, I guess you'd call it a graphic novel called Classics Illustrated. I can remember reading A Tale of Two Cities or Robinson Crusoe, and then eventually going on to reading the bigger tomes, so to speak, that would have been seen so intimidating before doing it. I was wondering what your guests thought about using graphic novels to explain some of the great works of literature and if that can still be done.
thanks so much for that question. So I really love the classics illustrated genre. I'm so glad that you brought it up. And it's kind of amazing that there is, for example, a classics illustrated version of Moby Dick. So this is a publishing enterprise that began in the 1940s, and so many people that I talk to about comics have mentioned their love for the form, starting with reading these adaptations. And I'm of sort of two minds about it. I think that one of the things that comics as a medium does best is to distill and condense ideas. So I think that it's actually a really wonderful form for adaptation because of its powers of economy, its ability to convey a complex idea in a 2-inch high panel that has both words and images in it. I worry sometimes, though, as a person who loves comics so much, that all of the focus on adaptation that we see around comics these days can sometimes make comics seem like the easier or less difficult version of a sophisticated work. And I'm always interested in trying to demonstrate and to show to people how sophisticated comics are on their own. So I absolutely love the Classics Illustrated series, but I hope that people can also see that comics have a lot of their own great ideas, and they're not just a form that makes something difficult easier.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Matt in Alouez. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. I'd like to talk about Watchmen. When it came out, I was reading it in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and we didn't have the internet, and it came out 1 month at a time. They eventually made it into a graphic novel, but since then, it's been really hard to get people to understand it because they're given it in a format in which they get the whole thing all at once. And when I got it back in the 80s, we had to wait a month to a month and a half for each issue, and it was really groundbreaking because every single panel mattered, and we actually had long discussions at night about it, and it was like a mystery we were trying to solve, and it was just really mind-boggling, and it kind of ruined comics for me because it showed me how much depth you could go into with a comic book.
Thank you for the call, Matt.
So I'm so glad that you brought up Watchmen. And I think this whole issue of serialization that you're talking about is such an important part of the experience of reading comics. So the graphic novel version of Watchmen, which collected all of the single issues, came out in 1986, which is the same year that Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which I've mentioned before, also came out. Its first volume was published in 1986. And Mouse had also been serialized in Art Spiegelman and Francoise Mouly's Raw magazine, chapter by chapter. And so I think there's a kind of tension with this idea of the graphic novel. I think for a lot of people, what graphic novel as a concept or as a term designates is a long work between covers. And there are a lot of works that are created to be original graphic novels. So we first read them, we first have access to them as a long-form book. But I do want to make sure that these serial histories are legible in the history of comics because it's such an important sort of way that comics is democratic, accessible, and also it's a way that comics taps into something deep about storytelling and sort of leaving you on the edge, wanting more. Charles Burns's amazing graphic novel, Black Hole, for example, which was published by Pantheon in 2005, came out over 10 years. And this was a comic book story that I followed, and I waited, months for each issue. So I can really sympathize or empathize and, you know, feel connected to the caller's comment about waiting for the next issue of Watchmen and this idea that every panel counted because you knew you'd be encountering a short work that was one piece of the story that would help you stitch together this this long-form narrative. So I don't want that history to be lost, even though there's such a great attention on the book as the object in the graphic novel scene today.
Well, you were talking about Watchmen. Another comic/graphic novel that has gained a lot of popularity over the years is The Walking Dead. And of course, you know, people watch The Walking Dead, and based on, you know, what happens in the TV show, they're often pointing out the differences between what's going on in the comic or the graphic novel and what's actually happening on the TV show and how closely are they following it. Is that one of the potential pitfalls of trying to take a graphic novel and then putting it on the small screen or in some cases the big screen?
Well, that's such an interesting example. I actually had a student at the University of Chicago where I used to teach who wrote a college thesis about some of the differences between the Walking Dead TV show and the comic book, especially around issues of sexual violence and trauma. So, you know, there are a lot of people, like you said, who are paying a lot of attention to the differences. I mean, in my view, anything that calls people's attention to the originary source material is a good thing. So I think in this day and age, you know, there are the small screen adaptations of comics works. There are obviously the big screen adaptations of comics works like Black Panther. And my hope is that that attention to these stories will return people to the comics themselves at some point and will sort of help float the comics industry. So I'm always happy when comics stories gain a wider audience because I hope there are more people who will seek out the original.
We have just a couple more minutes, so I want to ask you just a couple things. And one, I want to acknowledge that Denny was on hold and he wanted to know about the Belgian influence in American comic books and if you know anything about that.
Yes. So the so-called Franco-Belgian school of comics is hugely influential to many of the styles of American comics. So I mentioned Tintin before by the cartoonist who went by Hergé. So that's a very famous, globally famous work of comics coming out of the Franco-Belgian school. And one of the signature stylistic features of Tintin comics is what is called the clear line style of Hergé. And that has become a sort of widely beloved and sort of widely celebrated style of comics that has a huge influence on people like Charles Burns, who I just mentioned a moment ago, and many, many other cartoonists. So it's a fundamental influence.
In about 20 seconds, can you recommend one comic that someone should read?
Absolutely. The graphic novel Sabrina by Nick Dronasso, which came out this year and was the very first graphic novel to ever be longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It's a work of fiction. It's about conspiracy theory. It's about trauma. It's contemporary. It's about the military. It's a powerful take on contemporary violence. It's a
Hillary, thank you so much for joining us. Hillary Chute is an expert on comics and graphic narratives and a distinguished professor of English and art and design at Northeastern University. Many of us have spent time watching Sesame Street over the years, whether with our children or as kids ourselves.
Well, thanks to a new project between Sesame Workshop and Warner Music Group, lots of those tunes from the past 5 decades are now available for streaming.
There's always been a great variety of music, some original to the show.
Now, what starts with the letter C? Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for Cookie. That's good.
And some covers of their own songs by well-known musical artists who sesamified their lyrics.
Happy, happy. See them jump and run. Happy, happy. Laughing all the
That was R.E.M. with Furry Happy Monsters from their hit Shiny Happy People.
Of course, the best Sesame Street song was the theme, and it's been going through my head all day, Darrell. How can you not smile when you hear it?
This is Central Time.
Sunny day, sweeping up.